So I will now introduce the speaker, who is Sarah Gunham. Sarah is on the National Executive of Socialist Alternative and has been involved in many different campaigns against oppression and against inequality, famously having led the campaign against deregulation of university fees many moons ago. So without any further ado, I will introduce Sarah.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Oppression is a phenomenon that is the sort of systemic and sustained discrimination against groups of people based on arbitrary characteristics or traits that they happen to possess or are designated as possessing. And it doesn't exist as a phenomenon outside of class societies. This kind of structural, systemic form of oppression has never existed in any society that hasn't been based around class. It is, however, an absolutely core feature of capitalism. And I think because capitalism is an economic and political system that relies upon the exploitation and oppression of the vast majority, it needs to clearly find ways to ensure that majority are repressed, are pressed down upon, as the word oppression would imply, are incapable of exerting their power over society and so on. And so oppression, the systemic and sustained discrimination of groups of people, does this job of repressing the majority, preventing them from exerting their will in a number of ways. Firstly, it makes sections of the population profoundly less confident to be involved in political activity and in society at large. Secondly, it creates the idea that there are substantial and unbridgeable divisions between human beings within that vast majority. And thirdly, it channels political discontent and agitation away from the rulers of our society and towards other victims of our society. So all of these things are what makes oppression absolutely necessary and beneficial to the capitalist class. But that doesn't mean that the capitalist class are sort of involved in some weird conspiracy where they sort of leak oppressive discriminatory ideas through aeroplane fuel or something like that. It actually means that there are a whole bunch of structures that have been built up over time under capitalism and those that predate capitalism as well that have remained and have sort of structural integrity because the class that's in power in society is benefiting from them. This means that systems of oppression become very entrenched historically, and each form of oppression, I think, plays a different social role, but as a kind of tapestry together, they are all very, very effective in stabilising the capitalist system. Okay, so that's some general things about oppression. Now I want to talk about some of the specific forms of oppression that do exist under capitalism. So the list of people oppressed under capitalism because of particular characteristics they have is very, very long. So it includes the working class, it includes women, LGBTI people, which is handy because that's a lot just in one quick word, immigrants, Aboriginal people, refugees, oppressed nations, the elderly, children, etc. So I'm not going to go through all of the ways that oppression works against all of those different groups of people. But I want to talk about a few of the key forms of oppression and then draw out some of the similarities and some of the particulars. So to start with, the oppression of the working class. So the working class are oppressed in a number of ways. They're systematically discriminated against by several institutions. They have, much crapper healthcare, education, fewer amenities. There's chronic underfunding of transport and other services in working class communities, working class schools are underfunded, the kind of education that working class people have access to in terms of teaching resources, the kind of treatment they get from authorities in the school system and so on, differs enormously from the kind of deluxe model of like the most elite private schools. So from a very young age, working class people feel the pinch of that and so on. And this is all before working class people even get to work, and we talk about the treatment of working class people at work, which is not just some sort of economic system of exploitation, it is also a system of extreme oppression. So workers at work are monitored. Some workers are monitored literally every second. They wear earpieces and, you know, what are those things called, like step meter things, so they're recorded of, you know, how much they're walking across the warehouse, if they're, you know, lifting boxes quick enough, if they're stopping to chat to their workmates, and so on. Workers are given no control over their work life. They do not control what happens to them at work, the kind of conditions that they're subjected to in terms of, you know, certain chemicals that they might be exposed to, as we saw with the outrageous situation of workers literally having toxic chemicals, you know, explode in their face in a factory just here, in a warehouse just here in Melbourne. But more generally, they're not given control over what they're producing, what the purpose of their work is, where the products of their labour are distributed or any of that. So you think of, like, even teachers who are workers who are not seen as, you know, often comparable to warehouse workers with earpieces and monitoring devices. But actually, teachers do not have any autonomy or control collectively either over the curriculum, the conditions of their work, and that kind of thing. Working class people are also excluded culturally and politically. So they're, shock and horror, not represented in Parliament, people might have noticed. And there is never any talk of the Liberal Party introducing quotas to rectify that situation. They're not represented in culture hardly at all. Barely any Hollywood movies tell the, you know, lovely, romantic, fun story of working class people's lives. And, you know, sometimes they're represented in sitcoms, but it's usually very, like, disparaging or annoying representations, like Everybody Loves Raymond. But on top of this, working class people are actually actively persecuted in the media. So working class people do not get a mention when, you know, they do anything positive, like win a strike or demonstrate progressive attitudes towards some social question, for example, same-sex marriage. But as soon as someone needs to be blamed for Donald Trump or Brexit, suddenly the working class exists again, and these are the people responsible for these things, which isn't actually even true in the case of Trump, but also, yeah, it's a very jaded and hostile representation of the working class. And then on top of that, working class people are persecuted by the police, the legal system, all of these state structures of repression and imprisonment. Okay, so the next major form of oppression I want to discuss is racism. Racism, I think, is often talked about as being something that's linked to some sort of human, timeless human psychology of in-group, out-group kind of psychological dynamics, that people are inherently worried or suspicious of the outsider into their social group and so on. I think this is absolute bullshit. I think it's an insult to what racism actually means for people who suffer it, and it's an insult to millions of years of human experience that does not demonstrate that because someone, you know, meets someone from another land, that they are all of a sudden, you know, think that there is some qualitative difference between them and that other human being. So actually, racism is something that has arisen because of very concerted and deliberate structures that have been built to categorise people on the basis of their religion, how much melanin is in their skin, what country they come from, as somehow lesser, different, malicious, and so on. And all of that is, nothing about that is inherent to human nature, but it absolutely is inherent and has been from the start to capitalism. So if you look at the treatment of Muslim people today, you know, what is the structural oppression that Muslims face? Well, firstly, their very countries that they come from are being bombed, have been blown to smithereens by Western armies, including our own. There are special laws in, you know, most Western states that apply just to Muslims, and sometimes these are very, very, you know, cleverly coded as something other than, you know, anti-Muslim laws, such as anti-terror laws. Which, you know, for anyone who has any, you know, political pulse knows what that means. Muslim people are targeted by every state authority, and, you know, people as young as 12 years old in this country have been hauled before courts where they have hardly any rights, certainly not the rights that people have under other courts, just for being Muslim. And all of that treatment that Muslim people face as a result of anti-terror laws, and yet they, as we've just seen, have just been the victims of a racist terror attack. Muslim people also persecuted in the streets, treated with suspicion. Muslim women in this country regularly get their headscarves ripped off, racist taunts, and so on. Then you look at Aboriginal oppression. It's a different form of racism, but absolutely it's structural. You know, it's about land theft, first and foremost. That's what Aboriginal oppression is about. And that land theft has been carried out, especially in recent times, by governments, both Liberal and Labor governments, as well as big mining companies and all of that. Aboriginal people also face huge rates of their children actually actively being stolen, one of the most inhuman things you could do to someone. The rates of Aboriginal children being removed from their parents today are actually greater than they were during the official stolen generation period, which I think demonstrates something about oppression, which is that when there has been a move beyond being able to explicitly justify something on the basis of, you know, some racist trope, often capitalist governments and the ruling class just find other ways to continue that oppression, but with a different kind of way of sanctioning it. So today children are not stolen because they're Aboriginal, but in effect that is actually, of course, what goes on. Okay, so racism is structural, and I think it's worth talking about, well, what are the reasons for structures of racism to exist? So there's a bunch of different ones, because there's lots of different forms of racism. So one is the theft of land, and all Indigenous people who have you know, been invaded by colonial armies or imperial armies have faced the brunt of that, that the not just the land, but the very kind of sovereign rights of a people on a particular piece of land need to be undermined in order for capitalist production to begin in that country. Secondly, production of difference is an important part of racism and why it needs to be structurally maintained. And by this I mean, like, bosses, literally within sites of production, so workplaces, finding ways to sort of antagonise different groups of people on a racial basis in order to drive down particular sections of the workforce into accepting lower wages and so on. And actually slavery, which is key to the formation of racism under capitalism, was about exactly this. It was about finding a group of people who would work for free on, you know, to get production set up, established under early capitalism. And in order to do that, you needed to find a whole set of ideologies and systems to argue that these people should be enslaved because they're somehow different to white people and so on. But that still goes on, leaving aside slavery, of, you know, immigrants being paid less. Somehow, you know, their immigrant status means they should be paid half the minimum wage, all of these kind of things. And bosses actually at, you know, just particular workplaces finding ways to racially segregate the workforce and so on. Thirdly, imperialism and nationalism are absolutely core to why racism always exists under capitalism, that as soon as you have capitalist classes across different nation states who want to compete with one another, that competition has to be justified in all sorts of ways. It needs to be justified to the people within a particular country as we're all part of some national unit who has a shared interest in invading Iraq, for example, but also you need to justify the invasion of Iraq by demonising the people that live there, their way of life, their culture, their race, and so on and so on. And I think the fact that imperialism and nationalism are changing kind of systems within capitalism, that imperialism never sits still. The global competition between different capitalist nations will always be changing. New alliances formed, you know, old ones broken, and so on. And that's one of the key reasons that you can see with racism a massive shifting of targets over a very short period of time. So Muslims, who I talked about before, you know, were not actually the subject of the kind of extreme focused racism that they have been for the last two decades, you know, in the 90s and so on, because it was not the focus of Western imperialism to be dominating the Middle East in exactly the way they are now, and so on. So there's been a whole bunch of different groups in Australia who have suffered extreme racism, and then within a decade, kind of like the ruling class has moved on to another group of people because the people they're warring with have changed. So you think of the Germans, the Japanese, the Irish, like whole waves of groups of people who have been racially discriminated in Australia who no longer are. Okay, another point about that is it actually does demonstrate that racism doesn't just come from ordinary people's heads, because the fact that it can be so superficially grafted onto just another group of people, often the same old prejudices, is an example that these are not deeply held ideas that, you know, just we've had as oxygen since we've birthed or something like that. Now I want to talk about sexism. So sexism is one of the oldest forms of oppression. While there was no basis for it prior to class society, it actually emerged not just with capitalism, but with the some of the first class societies. And that's why Frederick Engels described the emergence of class as linked to the historic defeat of the female sex. And I think you can see symbols of that defeat absolutely everywhere in society. Every billboard, Donald Trump, like symbols of that defeat are just everywhere. Women are sexualized, they're abused, they're economically subjected to an inequality in every field of life. It's obviously the case to people in this room, I would assume, that we're not living in some post-sexist society. We've just seen the last year a huge wave of, awareness about sexism with the Me Too movement that demonstrates just how pernicious the kind of inequalities between men and women are, and how, in particular, men in positions of power, bosses and so on, can use that to further intimidate women workers in particular, and so on. And I think sexism has to be so pervasive and endemic to capitalism because it allows for enormous gains for the capitalist class. So, for example, there is a gender pay gap and a substantial gender pay gap on every country on Earth. And that's important because women are half the population or more, and almost half the population of the workforce. So being able to use a whole set of ideologies and systems to justify a whole section of the workforce being exploited harder, being paid less, is, of course, extremely beneficial to the upkeep of the boss's profit machine. Secondly, I think the family unit under capitalism is really important, and the family unit has been historically and will, I think, continue to be justified as natural on the basis of sexism. So the family, not the collective institution of our society, organises the rearing of every new generation of workers, and a huge amount of labour goes into that. So, workers are babies before they're workers. They have to be looked after. They have to be attended to when they get sick, all of that kind of thing. But that goes on for quite some time. And all of that is private labour done by the private household, the family unit, within which women are still expected to play the predominant role. So expected to do the majority of labour, are not paid for that labour, and are expected to do so because that's their natural social role. The family has become definitely more casually kind of observed, I think, in recent decades. So there's not the same sort of rigid, almost religious hold to this kind of like, you know, you have to have the monogamous marriage sorted out when you're like 16 and then have a whole brood of kids or whatever. And like all of that's changed a bit. There's a whole... Everything that is holy is profaned. Married at First Sight is the the most popular show in Australia, apparently. It's a very tacky, iteration of the family. And there's all sorts of ways that just like broken families, and more LGBTI families have sort of been incorporated into the general idea of the family. But I think even though there is that sort of flexibility, there is still an absolute expectation that this is the sort of natural social role for women. And I think one of the things that indicates how the flexibility of sort of some of the aspects of the family unit is only superficial is the ongoing rigidity of gender roles. And I think that's really important because recognizing the centrality of the family means that there you have to recognize the gender binary that goes along with that. And I think it's no sort of rocket science to work out how homophobia and then transphobia fit very nicely within that and sort of have to fit within that. So the gender binary that we're all familiar with, you know, says that there are just girls in one column, boys in another, and that into these columns fit a range of characteristics, including your sexual preferences, but even more importantly, all sorts of social roles, interests, habits, and so on, that you will exhibit in accordance to one or other of two rigidly defined genders. And I think anything that deviates from this is seen as a threat. And that you can see that with the emergence of homophobia. Homophobia was not a timeless form of oppression that existed in response to, different forms of sexual activity and so on. It didn't actually emerge until the classification of the homosexual emerged. And the homosexual needed to be classified as a type of person in society precisely because finding a way to medically and legally define these people was a way of defining the threat and defining something as unnatural outside of the parameters of the gender binary and the family unit that gender binary is supposed to fit. And so I think that is still the case today, that if people's sexuality doesn't correlate with the predominant kind of heterosexual family unit and so on, they still face enormous oppression. But these days we are seeing a wider range of sexualities accepted. And the kind of real, I suppose, vicious side and blunt side of home of that kind of exact same thing turned towards trans people. I think trans people are some of the most oppressed people in our society today. From sports to the prison system, trans people face enormous oppression on the streets. Basically in every facet of society, trans people are discriminated against, are seen as deviant and so on, and of course from a very young age as well. This structural oppression based on an ideology that we're forced to think there's an attempt to force people to think is natural, that gender is natural and that gender also correlates with anatomy, all of that is an example of how deeply entrenched oppressive systems under capitalism can become. So on the one hand, it's true what I said before, that like the superficial nature of oppression means that the targets of racism can change. On another level, because oppression goes on for so long, there are so many systems that preside over it and so on, these ideas do take root and some of the most oppressive ideas do kind of form common sense or natural ideology and so on. Okay, so now I want to talk about just quickly that the question of intersection, because I think that it's important to say that under capitalism, there are hardly any forms of oppression that people suffer discreetly. Pretty much every person who is oppressed in one particular way is also oppressed in other ways, and I think that's important. So firstly, that has to be true because the majority of the population is the working class. That's like 70% of the population. And the working class are the biggest oppressed group, therefore. But also, the working class includes women, trans people, refugees, migrants, Aboriginal people, and so on. So there is a reality to the experiences that confront you if you suffer not just one, but two or more forms of those oppression. That makes the oppression greater in some ways qualitatively different as well. And I think it's important to see those links of intersection because people are recognising that there's some, shared experiences that are faced by different groups who are oppressed is very important for forging links of solidarity. So recognising that we're not all just kind of facing our own discrete oppressions because of some especially externally visible characteristics is important because there's lots of different ways the different sections of the oppressed are overlapping in their oppressions and so on. Okay, now I want to talk about strategies to fight oppression, and I want to go through three fairly quickly. The three I want to go through are firstly the approach of building broad and cross-class alliances of people who suffer a particular form of oppression. The second one I want to go through is the strategy of interrogating people's privilege, making them aware of it, and trying to undermine it. And thirdly, I want to talk about the revolutionary socialist approach to combating oppression. So firstly, on the approach that is basically like we should get everyone together who shares a form of oppression in a big grouping, regardless of what social class they come from, and so on. That approach, I think, is one that's been tried and tested and is something that we should, particularly in the modern era, really reject. There can be a basis for example, all women to share a momentary interest in one particular reform. But the reality is that that is a very, very fleeting moment, and it's because that group is crossed by extremely important class divisions which do assert themselves. Especially today, when we're living in a time when a lot of the most kind of simple legal reforms that could have been won for women, such as the right to vote, the right to have your own bank account, not your husband's, that kind of stuff, those things have been won. And so the struggles for, gender equality, women's equality and so on beyond that are not struggles that are shared by ruling class women in the slightest. And if you think about ruling class women, it's not difficult to, work that out. Like Hillary Clinton is the classic example as, an absolute shark of Wall Street and, has no interest in ordinary women's lives, especially not if they're in the Middle East. But, there's heaps of other ruling class women that are, clearly have nothing to do with the struggle of working class women or, like the Queen, like all sorts of CEOs. That's just, I don't know why I thought of that, because that one also existed before women became capable of being CEOs or Democratic Party candidates. So there's always been that kind of thing, ruling class women who don't share the interests of the working class women. But today we're living through a time where there's more of that. There are more women in boardrooms, heading major banks, that kind of thing. And these people do not share an interest in our struggles. And this is true for every oppressed group. It's the same for black people. Barack Obama was not a representative of working class black people's interests. And I think it's important to see that this is because class is actually such an important category. And so of all the oppressed groups that I talked about, class is the one group that doesn't face that compromising reality. When the working class is grouped together as a whole block, it is not cut through with lines of, with class lines. There are not ruling class sections of the working class who are trying to undermine the struggles of the rest of the block, whereas every other of these oppressed groups is riven by that division if you see it as a whole homogenous block. And I think that's important because, as I've talked about, the structures of oppression are actually structures of capitalism, and the maintenance of that system is the essential dynamic that goes on in all society. So figures within that class, the capitalist class, who want to maintain that system will absolutely be one to a program of wanting to enforce the structures of oppression that uphold their system and their position within it. And time again, we've seen people from oppressed groups get into ruling class structures and demonstrate exactly that. The second sort of strategy I want to talk about and critique is the strategy of just pointing to people's privilege and then trying to sort of, fight oppression by making society and members of society more aware of these privileged dynamics. I think it's a good instinct that people want to cut against the right-wing bigoted attitudes that exist in society and want to talk about how oppression actually affects people, the experiences of the oppressed, and in that way not just cut against the most abjectly revolting bigotry, but also just the kind of complacency that people who don't suffer a particular form of oppression might adopt towards people of an oppressed group, the just unawareness of the kind of experiences they're facing. But I think it's important to refute this as a strategy because actually it is a very defeatist strategy to adopt. Firstly, because the lack of oppression is simply not a privilege. It does not make you privileged to not be detained in Manus Island right now. It is disgusting that refugees face that. It is not a privilege to be outside of bars. It's not a privilege to be a working class person who doesn't, get raped by your boss at work. These are not privileges. They are the absence of a particularly disgusting form of oppression. But that does not make that person a privileged person, and I think it leads to a grossly distorted assessment of what actually constitutes privilege in a society where literally a handful of people own more wealth than the bottom half of humanity. This is not a privilege to not be hounded by the police or something on your way home from the train. But secondly, I think that it's important to see that experiences and the conditions that particular groups of people face under capitalism are not just synonymous with their interests. And so though it's the case that all sorts of people within the oppressed classes and sections of society face different forms of oppression and have different experiences, actually there is a common interest amongst all of those people that's not overridden by the fact that not everyone can say, I've had exactly that same experience as you. The interest that certain people have, for example, in overthrowing the capitalist class, in actually living in a society free from these kind of oppressions, transcends the fact that there might not necessarily be a similarity of experience. And I think that relates to the fact that, in the end, the politics of just making people aware of their privilege, which I don't believe is privilege, is not actually about trying to find the shared interests that groups of oppressed people or groups within society face and use that to build a movement capable of liberation. It is much more just about, discussing experiences of oppression, trying to understand them perhaps, but not actually take any decisive action towards bettering anyone's conditions. So lastly, just to quickly talk about the revolutionary socialist approach to combating oppression. I think that, firstly, seeing that, especially when you understand that working class people and people oppressed by their class position in general throughout human history are also part of the oppressed layers in society, it's important to see that the fight against oppression has actually been the driving force for social change. Every slave revolt, every peasant revolt, every workers' strike, every riot, every national liberation movement, all of these things are the cries of the oppressed, and they are a struggle that comes out of the fact that human beings do not just sit around accepting their oppression. They do not just fall victim to it. They want to fight back against the structures and experiences of inequality. That's really important. The whole history of humanity has been a history of people refusing to tolerate the kind of shit that I've talked about. But I think we also have to say that resistance, just raw resistance, is not enough, and that we in Socialist Alternative are in the business of fighting for liberation. We actually want to fight for a system that is based on no prejudice, no discrimination, where people actually have human dignity, are treated as equals, and face none of the shit that pushes people down today. And I think the having that vision is important, not just for, the grand strategies that inform that vision, but for the fights of today. All of the fights that we have to, be involved in today and all of the struggles that go on under capitalism have gone on throughout the history of capitalism to win reforms against oppression. They matter. They give people a sense of confidence. It matters that the civil rights movement happens. It mattered that, we had a women's movement that demanded the vote and then demanded equal pay. It mattered that we won marriage equality just a couple of years ago. So we need to celebrate those victories because of what they represent. They represent the fact that the structures of the capitalist system, the oppressive structures, are not infallible. They're not just these unbreakable chains. We can start to chip away at them. But there's also a reality to the fact that they will always be recreated and reforged under a system that demands the repression of the vast majority, as I started with. And so there is no way that any of the reforms we win, even if some of them are more lasting than others, will just slowly over time eradicate oppression altogether. The system depends on it. And to understand that means to aim higher, to be involved in all of the movements against oppression today, but also to aim for a world that can rid society of oppression altogether. And I think socialism is the only world that could possibly offer that. And I'll finish with that because it's important. I think it's important not just because the struggle for socialism will actually involve a massive, massive pushback against all of the oppressive ideologies that we face. That's the reality of the revolution that people keep talking about. In this conference. It's not just a particular section of the working class. It's not just a particularly educated section of socialists. It has to be the vast majority of the working class of human society rising up collectively against capitalism. For us to even get to that point, there needs to be a political process of people recognising who their allies are, where solidarity lies, and all of that kind of thing. That's why Lenin argued the Bolshevik Party needed to become not just the voice of the working class, but the tribune of the people, the tribune of every oppressed minority throughout Russia and throughout the world. So that process of a revolution will necessarily involve a huge confrontation with the ideologies of oppression. But more importantly, the kind of society that a socialist revolution could build is one that would have absolutely zero need for oppression. And that's really important. As soon as a society actually dismantles the profit motive, dismantles the ruling class and starts to organise production on an egalitarian and collective basis, there is absolutely no reason for sections of society to be arbitrarily designated as lesser in order to be paid less, in order to fulfil some sort of social function without getting any remuneration, any of those kind of things that inform the core structures of oppression. So that doesn't mean that people's ideas will immediately all change. We're not, socialists do not say that day two of the revolution, everyone will, you know, have no racist, sexist baggage. Of course, ideas will live on for a little while. But ideas that don't have any material reality fail to get any oxygen and fail to be replicated. So if you think, how could you have a bias of racism towards refugees in a society where there were no refugees? You know, how could you have like homophobia in a society where there was no sanctioned homophobia, there was no structural oppression? It doesn't make sense over time. And so it's not that, you know, people can cling to conservative ideas, some people will more than others. But in every revolution that we've seen thus far, and obviously none of them have, you know, completed the task and built socialism, there has been an incredible transformation of the way people think about other groups within the oppressed majority. And so I think there's no question that people will overcome those things. And I think I just want to end quickly with something that Frederick Engels said in relation to sexual oppression, because I think it sums up the kind of limits of our ability to imagine how quickly people will move and how radically people's ideas of what it means to be part of a human society will be once they live in a free society. So he says, what we can now conjecture about the way in which sexual relations will be ordered after the impending overthrow of capitalist production is mainly of a negative character, limited to the most part of what will disappear. But what will there be new? That will be answered when a new generation has grown up. They will care precious little what anybody today thinks they ought to do. They will make their own practice and their corresponding public opinion about the practice of each individual. And that will be the end of it.